Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S., and Iran's Global Ambitions, by Arash Azizi, narrated by Eric Jason Martin. Introduction. Hashtag World War III. When the ominous hashtag started trending globally, it was evening in New York on January 2nd, 2020, and already the morning after in the Middle East. The new decade was off to a stormy start. The social media craze had been caused by an American drone strike on Iraq's capital, Baghdad. Killing military opponents in the Middle East was hardly a rare event, but this wasn't just any strike, and the main man it had killed wasn't just any opponent. At around 12:47 a.m. local time, U.S. Predator B drones fired several missiles at two vehicles leaving Baghdad International Airport. They killed 10 people in the convoy, including the top intended target, Iran's Major General Qasem Soleimani. Initial rumors about his death were confirmed when pictures were published of his severed arm, his digitus medicinalis adorned with a signature amulet ring. Soleimani was gone. The world panicked, and many didn't know how to react. Like a mythical bandit in a folktale, Soleimani had been larger than life. The commander of the Quds Force, the external operations branch of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC, ruled over a global army of tens of thousands of Shia Muslim fighters. He moved seamlessly across borders, as if he could be present in more than one place at the same time. The shadow commander had been a man without a shadow, but now he was merely a mutilated corpse. His last hours fit his reputation. Barely 7 minutes prior to his death, he had touched down in Baghdad on a flight from Damascus. Shortly before, he had been in Beirut, the gorgeous Mediterranean port, and one of at least five capitals in which Qasem was among the most powerful men. The decision to assassinate Soleimani counted as bold and reckless by any standard. Not since 1943, when the Americans shot down the plane carrying Marshal Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto of the Imperial Japanese Navy, had the United States killed such a high-ranking military official. President Donald Trump had made up his mind a few days before at his Mar-a-Lago resort, where he spent New Year's Eve conferring with his top cabinet members, including CIA Director Gina Haspel, who raised eyebrows by advocating for the action. A few hundred kilometers to the west, across the Florida Peninsula, United States Central Command headquarters in Tampa hatched the plans. The operation came a few days later. It was a devastating success. The world now held its breath for what was to come next. The 82nd Airborne Division sent thousands of its soldiers to the region, the largest such expeditionary action in years. The British Royal Navy started escorting ships in the Persian Gulf. From Mexico to Nigeria to Thailand, police forces were alerted to be prepared for the consequences. In Brazil, a social media panic erupted, with users worried that Iran might mistakenly retaliate against the entire Americas. Soleimani's demise stunned the world. Who was this commander? Qasem Soleimani hadn't always been a name to be reckoned with. When he was born in the Iran of 1956, few in his small mountain village could have predicted the emergence of a global military celebrity from their midst. How had it come to this? How was it that a boy from the margins of Iranian society rose to become a commander feted by thousands and feared by many more? This is the central question at the heart of this book. I tell the story of a man and his rise to power, of how his world changed and how he changed his world. We must therefore begin at the beginning. Years before Qasem became a commander, he was a young man on the periphery. Chapter 1. A Life on the Margins. A foreign traveler to Iran once retold the story of an encounter somewhere in the borderlands of the country. Meeting a local villager, he spoke of his love for Iran, whereupon the startled villager asked, "Where is Iran? I know all the villages in this area, and we don't have any with such a name. We don't know how much truth there is to this apocryphal tale, but it illustrates a point about life on the margins of the Iranian plateau. The great urban jewels of Iran have long seduced many a visitor, but the people of its pastoral and rural borderlands have been something of a silent majority, a mystery, or a danger. Now castigated as disloyal subjects who don't belong, then lauded as heroic keepers of the marshlands and guardians of the nation. This is tribal Iran. The tribes of Iran are diverse and changing in their ethnicity, language, religion, and mode of life. Their fortunes rise and fall with the tides of history and events near and far. One event that affected them all was the rise to power in the 1920s of an ambitious young monarch named Reza Pahlavi. Backed by many of the country's modernizing intellectuals who were disillusioned with the chaos that had followed the ups and downs of the constitutional revolution of 1905 to 1906, Reza wanted a centralized and effective state and had to wage war against anything that stood in his way. The nomadic tribes definitely made the list, and many of the nationalist intellectuals, opposing what they perceived as tribal backwardness, were enthusiastic about taking them on. Lacking permanent settlements, the tribes often migrated seasonally, taking their massive tents with them. They were equipped with their own arms, and consequently the state apparatus had limited penetration into the lives of tribal peoples. They spoke a variety of languages, some Persian or a close sibling, Luri, but many Turkic, Azeri, Kurdish, Arabic, or Baluchi. If Reza Shah wanted to build his centralized state, he had to suppress the tribes, and so he did. Traditional clothes and the black tents were banned, tribal confederations were broken, and many tribes were forcibly settled. The process of forced settlement came to be known by a Turkic term, takte kapu, which simply means building a wooden gate, seen as the most conspicuous sign of a resettled tribe. The term still disturbs many, and tribal histories still speak with fear and trembling of the young monarch's campaign of terror against them. Reza had gone on the record describing the tribal peoples as illiterate, unproductive, abnormal tent-dwelling savages left in their primitive state for too long. The young monarch wasn't alone. Ignorant of the cosmopolitan histories of these tribes, the country's literati held similar conceptions. In the southern province of Kerman, not far from the waters of the Persian Gulf, the tribes hadn't played the pivotal role that their counterparts had elsewhere in Iran. They weren't kingmakers, allies of revolutionaries, or armed accomplices to foreign governments, but they had the most colorful mercantile history. The provincial urban center of Kerman sat not far from Bandar Abbas, the old port on the Persian Gulf, which got its current name when the forces of Shah Abbas defeated the Portuguese in 1622, reconquering it after a century of European domination. Kicking out the Portuguese didn't lead to autarky. English, Dutch, and Portuguese merchants continued to pass through southern Iran, and each tribe in Kerman boasts its own stories of interactions with the European merchants and empires. By 1956, when our story begins, years of central state oppression had taken their toll. The tribes of Kerman province were no longer the international mercantile interlocutors of the past, and now languished on the margins of power and wealth in modern Iran. The forced settlement program was to intensify around this time. The province's most valued commodity, wool, particularly from the soft and fluffy hairs closest to a mammal's skin, known as down hair, ground hair, or undercoat, had seen a drop in price. Successive years of bad droughts had led to animal deaths. The tribes were devastated and struggled to find new avenues for livelihood. Girls would be raised to take part in the intensive and artful labor of producing the famed Kermani carpets for the markets, while young men would learn to drive, to become truckers perhaps, connecting central and southern Iran to the ports on the Persian Gulf via the roads that the new Shah of Iran, Reza's son, Mohammad Reza, was busy building. Not everybody chose such noble callings. Some held on to their rifles, hiding them from the central government, practicing road robbery, or engaging in petty crime. In the country of Rabur, a few hours' drive away from the city of Kerman, lies the small village of Connaught Mulk, with a population of a few dozen families. Rabur has something in common with many locales around the world. Villages in Jordan, hosting forcibly settled Bedouin, hill towns in Southeast Asia, home to sedentarized populations whose nomadic lives cannot be tolerated by modern states. The people of Connaught Mulk claimed common descent from a particular sub-tribe. They almost all shared the same last name, Soleimani, that is, people of Soleiman, the biblical Solomon, the mythical king of the Jews in whose magical qualities Muslims believed as fervently as their Abrahamic predecessors. The Soleimani's presence in Kerman dated back to the 18th century, when they had chosen to settle there on their way back from the Indian subcontinent, where they had fought under the command of the legendary Persian king Nader Shah, or so they claimed. This gave them seniority over the many tribes that had been displaced in the previous few decades or during the tumult of the 19th century. The village boasted beautiful walnut trees, which the local lore claimed as the oldest in the world. But there was little to market beyond the local level. In 1956, even the county seat of Rabur, less than 10 kilometers away from Connaught Mulk, was yet to be founded. That would happen only in 1962 by bringing together 5 smaller locales. There was no industry or factories, nor is there today. No significant site of the kind that brought tourists in droves to the neighboring Fars province to see beauties such as Persepolis or other ruins of the ancient Persian empires. No grand historical character, no famed Persian poet, no notable scientist of the golden age of Islam had ever emerged from this marginal part of Kerman. But that mattered little to the many who loved their part of the world. Ghulam Ali, who grew up in the 1960s in the nearby village of Nosratabad, just a stone's throw from Connaught Mulk, is full of fond memories. "The harsh winters bothered us, but the temperate spring and summer were so heavenly," he says. "The walnuts were famous, but we had so much more. Apples, pears, and even some exotic fruits, believe it or not. We even had our own olives, rumored to have come from Lebanon." Ghulam well remembers Nosratabad's village head, Khosro, or Kadkhoda Khosro, to use the Persian prefix. The retired Khosro still summers in Nosratabad while living in the nearby town of Jeroft. In the late 1950s, he had a close friend in Connaught Mulk, Hassan Soleimani. Born in 1922 into a small landowning family of peasants, Hassan had worked on his family's fruit gardens all his life. Kadkhoda Khosro remembers him as a hard-working and humorous man, just as he appears in a video interview from decades later. He had his first child at a relatively late age, being 33 when, in 1955, he and his wife, Fatima, had a daughter. Their first son arrived the following year. Like many Persian Muslims, they picked an Arabic name for him. The boy was to be called Qasem, Arabic for divider, and the name of a rare son of the Prophet Muhammad, who had many daughters but no son who survived to adulthood. More to the point, Qasem was the name of a great-grandson of the Prophet, born to Imam Hassan, the second Shia Imam. Hassan of Connaught Mulk now had his own Qasem, just like Imam Hassan of 1,400 years before. It was this son, Qasem, who would change the fate of this little village and much beyond. He would give this part of Kerman its first real celebrity, the first local boy who would make it. He'd be feted and known not only in the provincial center, Kerman, but in Tehran and the ancient Arab capitals that Connaught Mulkis had only heard about in stories, Damascus, Beirut, Baghdad. He'd even be welcomed and honored in Moscow, then one of the 2 superpower capitals of the world, and his image would appear on countless magazine covers the world over, causing fear and loathing in lands far from the pleasant walnut trees of central Kerman. The village saw dividends from this rise to power of the little boy who became Major General Qasem Soleimani. Helped by the general, Connaught Mulk would get amenities sooner than other villages. It would boast a workshop to produce herbal medicine and a massive mosque, partially built by the proud father himself. Until his death in 2016 at the age of 95, Hajj Hassan Soleimani was to never leave his small village of 300 families or so. "One feels better in one's homeland," he said in a video interview with a Kermani outlet a few years before this death. Qanat Mulk, with its pleasant cool breezes and sturdy walnut trees, was as good as one could wish for in a homeland. Today he is buried there, next to his wife, who predeceased him by a few years. But the small village has entered the annals of history due to the deeds of their first son. The general never lost touch with this corner of the world. He'd visit as often as he could. His career would have been nothing without the sons of the area that flocked to join the military force he built in the 1980s to fight against the Iraqi invasion. One wonders how the family of Ebrahim Araste, for example, thinks of General Soleimani. Born in 1971 in the village of Mohammadabad, Ibrahim went to Qanat Mulk, 3 kilometers away, for part of his schooling. Like many local boys, he worked hard to help his family from an early age. Life in Mohammadabad was even harder than in the relatively rich Qanat Mulk. The Shah's grandiose development projects were yet to bring running water to the village, and Halime, Muhammad's mother, sometimes accompanied by her daughters, had to walk to a stream nearby, even in the dead of winter, to wash clothes and dishes and bring water back, just like Victor Hugo's fictional Cosette 1.5 centuries before her. In his early teens, Muhammad, who couldn't bear to see his mother go through this, took action. He managed to find a water pump in Qanat Mulk and, not having the means to hire a car or get help, brought back the heavy piece all by himself, walking the 3 kilometers to Mohammadabad. Like many good family of farmers, the parents hoped to rely on such a hard-working son for years, but this wasn't to pass. In 1987, in the fields of Shalamka, on the Iranian-Iraqi border and not far from the port city of Basra, Ibrahim was killed by an Iraqi bullet, one of the up to 65,000 Iranians who died in the disastrous Iranian siege of Basra. His grave is there in Mohammadabad today, but it is empty, as his body has never been found. He was all of 15 years old. Muhammad was one of the many Kermanis mobilized by General Soleimani to fill the ranks of the Islamic Republic, a regime built in the name of the people of the margins. Before giving these people anything, the Republic needed them to perform that age-old duty, dying for the nation. This is one thing Qasem would turn out to be very good at, mobilizing people to fight and die. What he started with the tribal Kermanis, he'd repeat with astonishing success in lands far from his marginal home village. But before he could get there, he had to get out of Qanat Mulk. Qasem was born into an Iran run by a man around the age of his father. Born in 1919, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi was the first son of Reza, that very ambitious monarch who had brutalized the Iranian tribes to build his modernizing state. Reza's project and ambitions were typical of the statesmen of the region. He followed the lead of Mustafa Kemal Ataturk of Turkey and Amanullah Khan of Afghanistan, heads of states which, like Iran, had the rare distinction of being non-European realms never to be colonized. Reza particularly cherished the reform model of Ataturk. The two had met in Reza's first and only foreign trip during his reign, a state visit in 1934 to Turkey. In time away from interpreters, Reza had tried to converse with Ataturk in what he knew of the Turkic dialects of his native northern Persia, but didn't have much success as Ataturk's Anatolian Turkish, soon to become a standardized language, shorn of its Arabic and Persian loanwords, was quite different. This symbolized the distance between the two men. Ataturk had been a general in the armed forces of a grand empire, the Ottomans, had fought in a world war, had defeated the British and French, under the leadership of the UK's first Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, on the hills of Gallipoli. He had lived in Bulgaria and had seen something of the world. Reza had had to build his military career during Iran's worst times of chaos, following the dying days of the Qajar dynasty when the country was falling prey to Russia and Britain's great game in the region. The intrigues of London and Moscow called the shots in Iran before Reza rose to power, thanks to a UK-backed coup in 1921. The British had liked his military discipline, the only field in which he had some talent. Iran's new strongman flirted with republicanism before helping to replace the Qajars with a new dynasty, with himself as the founding king. Taking the ancient Persian name Pahlavi, the uncouth general, from a humble background, sought entry into the annals of the Iranian dynasties. Ataturk had inherited something of the impressive Ottoman state and traditions, whereas all Reza got was the remnants of the weak Qajar regime. He also had the support of at least some of the intellectual and political elites of the Persian constitutional revolution of 1905 to 1906, ranging from liberals to social democrats, but he was quick to suppress them. Like many a military man, Reza soon grew tired of his intellectual supporters. By 1941, when he was overthrown by the Anglo-Soviet invasion of Iran due to Allied worries about the country falling to Hitler's Germany, much of what the Iranian historian Turaj Atabaki was to call authoritarian modernization had failed to stick. Compared to Ataturk's Turkey, Reza created much more chaos and disharmony, with far fewer results to show for it. In 1941, as he departed Iran for a fatal exile in British-held realms, Mauritius, then South Africa, Reza gave the reins to his Swiss-educated 21-year-old son, Mohammad Reza. The young Shah was initially overshadowed by the country's raucous tribes, skilled politicians, and political parties, chiefly the Communist Tudeh Party, in the only democratic period in Iran's history. The democratically elected parliament occasionally returned communist MPs and cabinet ministers. It also became the base of power for Iran's progressive prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh. Backed by communists and a mass movement on the streets, Mossadegh took on the most powerful empire of his world, the British, but ended up becoming the first casualty of the world's newest imperial power. In 1953, the United States helped the British organize a coup, overthrow Mossadegh, crush the communists and all other political parties, and put an end to Iran's 12-year experience of democracy. The young Shah, now 33 years of age, had a new lease on life. No longer an overshadowed monarch, he was well on his way to becoming an all-powerful autocrat like his father. In 1958, after a communist-backed revolution overthrew the young monarchy in his neighboring Iraq, the Shah's fears grew and he cracked down further. The once vibrant parliament became a pliant rubber-stamp assembly, divided into two groups famously known as the Yes and Yes Sir parties. The Shah emerged to become a seminal figure in the colorful tapestry of the global Cold War. Iran had been central to the Cold War since day one. Historian Bruce R. Kuhnholm even claimed that the war had started in the Near East, with the Soviet-U.S. face-off in Iran being a big part of the story. Iran was to be a theater of the Cold War throughout its entire duration, and though they might not have known it, the lives of the people of Ghanat Mulk, too, were deeply affected by the ebbs and flows of that global conflict. The Cold War made lives of people around the world interconnected, but in deeply unequal waves. The decisions of a relatively few people in the swing states of the United States could change the lives of millions around the world, including the unsuspecting farmers of Ghanat Mulk. In the 1960 U.S. presidential elections, John F. Kennedy, a young senator from the state of Massachusetts, surprised the world by defeating the Republican governor of California, Richard Nixon. Who would have known that the people of the Midwestern state of Missouri would vote for a yuppie Boston Catholic? Although Barack Obama came close in 2008, to this day, no other Northern Democrat has ever carried Missouri. But on that fateful day of November 8, 1960, decisions by people like the farmers in the almost all-white Osage County of Missouri affected the fate of the world. The Soleimanis of Ghanat Mulk, Kerman, might not have known of Frankenstein, Missouri, but such small communities were interconnected in the context of the global Cold War. President Kennedy had promised to change the way the U.S. fought the Cold War. In 1958, a political novel by Eugene Burdick and William Lederer symbolized Kennedy's problem with the Cold War policies of his Republican predecessor, Dwight Eisenhower, the man who had approved the 1953 coup that ended democracy in Iran 3 years before our Qasem was born. Burdick and Lederer had both served in the Navy during the Second World War, with the latter rising to become an important captain in the Pacific Theater. They were now both disillusioned with the U.S. backing of tin-pot dictators in the Southeast Asia they had so valiantly fought to free from fascist Japanese aggression in the war. The novel was called The Ugly American. It was set in the imaginary country of Sarkhan, described as somewhere akin to Thailand or Burma, and obviously meant to represent that festering sore of the Cold War, Vietnam. Senator Kennedy loved the book so much that he sent a copy to all his colleagues in the Senate. The cinematic version, starring Marlon Brando, had to wait until 1963, but the book was already a phenomenon, ultimately selling 4 million copies, and might have had something to do with average Americans in places like Missouri turning to Kennedy. Americans don't usually care much about foreign policy. Did they want the quiet American the world knew to turn so quickly to an ugly American? Kennedy's message was clear. If the U.S. wanted to reduce communism's popularity in the Third World, it had to stop backing repressive dictators and instead give the people what the communists were promising them, development and jobs. In office, President Kennedy would make this something of a priority. In 1961, he launched the Peace Corps, a significant volunteer program which sent young Americans around the world. The Peace Corps Americans were to be the ultimate counterimage of the ugly American Brando portrayed in 1963, ambassadors of economic development and even justice. Early in his post-coup rule, the Shah was more pliant to Kennedy than he would be to his successors. Thus, when the liberal president pressured him to be more democratic and progressive, he gave in. But, like other liberal presidents before him, the young Bostonian was quick to find out that grandiose visions outlined on the pages of the New York Journal Foreign Affairs were not always easy to translate into policy, least of all in the rocky waters of the Cold War. In 1961, under pressure from Kennedy, the Shah appointed the reform-leaning, American-educated Ali Amini as prime minister. As ambassador to the U.S. in the post-coup years of 1955 to 1958, Amini had been so close to Washington as to irk the insecure Shah, who recalled him home. As a prime minister enforcing Kennedy's agenda, he was never to have the full cooperation of the Shah and the imperial court. Amini also failed to get any backing from the supporters of Mossadegh and the Iranian opposition, who considered any collaboration with the U.S.-installed Shah as political suicide, a sin they were not prepared to commit. Amini's premiership failed miserably, and a year later he was replaced by Asadollah Alam, his opposite in every imaginable way. Alam was a grand landowner from northeastern Iran who considered himself a humble and obedient servant of the Shah. With Alam at the helm and Kennedy out of the reckoning after his tragic assassination in 1963, the Shah had the chance to offer his own version of state-led development, one more attempt to bring happiness to people and stave off a communist revolution. What would this all mean for the people of Ganat Mulk and Qasem's family? How would lives change in this corner of Kerman province? Although his opponents would come to caricature him in that way, the Shah was no corrupt and nasty Cold War dictator like François Duvalier or Ferdinand Marcos. He saw himself not as a hidebound reactionary, but as a revolutionary and even a socialist who knew his people's interests better than the communists, and even better than his people themselves. And therein lay the problem. Writing sweepingly about different regimes around the world, anthropologist James Scott would come to criticize seeing like a state, in other words, implementing state-led plans from above that were well-meaning but rarely took into account the priorities of the people they wanted to help. In 1963, the benevolent autocrat of Iran declared the principles of his Revolution of Monarch and the People, nicknamed the White Revolution, to differentiate it from the Red Revolution it was meant to prevent. Not for the first time, the establishment decided to counter the opposition by adopting its agenda. Didn't the old Prussian Otto von Bismarck introduce social reforms to stem the rise of German social democrats, the party meant to work for the ideas of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels? The Shah's revolution had 19 principles, which read like the agenda of...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?